Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is July the 18th. We are up to the fourth chapter of Megillas Rus. And tonight, please God, we are going to finish Megillas Rus. So we left off that Boaz is now has to negotiate with his uncle, Tov, to see who is going to redeem the field of Naomi, and in so doing, would also marry Ruth. Now, we have not yet explained what the connection is between redeeming the field and marrying Ruth, but it's clear that Ruth and Boaz understand that the two things are related to each other, and it will be brought up over here as well. Uboaz Allah Hashar Vayeshev Sham. Boaz went up to the gate. The gate always means the Sanhedrin. He went to the high court, of which he presided. He was the Avbeis, and he was the head of it. So he went up there, and he sat there. Vinea Goel Overa Shadiber Boaz. And behold, the Goel, the Redeemer, was passing by, the one that Boaz spoke of. Vayomer, and he said, Surashvapo, turn and sit here, Ploni Almoni. Ploni Almoni means so-and-so. He's not giving his name. Vayasar Vayeshev, and he turned and he sat. So we need to understand why the phrase Ploni Almoni is used for this Goel. Why call him no name? Call him by his name, which some commentaries say his name was Tov. Why not refer to him by his name? And he took 10 men from the elders of the city, Vayomer Shvupo, and he said, sit here, Vayeshevu, and they sat. And now he had the people there to preside over what was about to happen. Vayomer LaGoel, he said to the Goel, the Redeemer, Chalkas HaSadeh, the portion of the field, Asher Le'achinu Le'Elimelech, that is to our brother, to Elimelech, it's literally their brother. It's Boaz's uncle, and it's the Goel's brother. The Goel is the brother of Elimelech. Machra Nami, Nami is about to sell it. Hashava Misedei Moav, and she returned from the fields of Moav. Vani Amarti, and I said, Eglaz Nechaleimor, I will reveal your ear, saying, Kinei, acquire it, Neged Ayoshvim Veneged Zignei Ami, in front of those who are sitting here, in front of the elders of my nation. Im Tigal Gal, if you want to redeem, redeem. Vim Lo Yigal, if you don't want to redeem, Hagid Ali, tell me, Ve'edon, I'll know, Ki Ein Zulas Chal Ligol, there's no one else besides you to redeem. I'm after you. That also implies that there were no children to the Goel, which we said we weren't sure whether he had any descendants, but if there was no one else to redeem besides the Goel and Boaz, it would seem that the immediate relatives are not alive if there were any. Vayomer, and the Goel said, Anochi Agol, I will redeem. Vayomer Boaz, Boaz said, the day you acquire the field from the hands of Naomi, you also have acquired Ruth, the Moavi woman, the wife of the deceased, to establish the name of the deceased on his portion, on his inheritance. Vayomer HaGoel, and the Goel said, Lo uchali goli, I cannot redeem for myself, penashchises nachalasi, lest I destroy my inheritance. Galacha atas gulasi, you should redeem my redemption, ki lo uchali goli, for I cannot redeem. Vezos lefanim b'Yisrael al ha-geula v'al tmura, this was done at times amongst the Jews for redemption and for exchanges, l'kayem kol davar, to establish everything. This is a way of making something final, of making a kinyan, making an acquisition. Shalaf ish na'alo v'nasan l'reyehu. A man would take off his na'al and give it to his friend. A na'al usually means a shoe, although in this context it might mean a glove. So he would take off his either shoe or glove and give it to his friend. V'zos ha-te'uda b'Yisrael. This was the, what word did they use for te'uda?
Attestation.
Okay, it's a little too fancy. Okay, process of ratification. This was the process amongst the Jews.
Manner of attesting.
Okay. So, Vayomer HaGoel LeBoaz Knei Lach. The Goel said to Boaz, acquire for yourself. Vayishlof Na'alo. And he took off his Na'al, again, either his shoe or his glove. Okay.
Could it be for Kenyan also?
What's that?
Kenyan?
Yeah, that's it's a Kenyan. It's an acquisition. Let's pause here. That's the first, we did the first eight, so again, the first eight verses. We're up to verse 9, Pasuk Tes. Let's stop here for a moment and let's cover a few points. So we want to know why he's being referred to as Ploni Almoni. That's one thing. We have to address what his concern is about losing his inheritance. That he doesn't want to marry Rus. We have to address what the connection is between marrying Rus and redeeming the field. We have to address what this kinyan, what this acquisition is, and we're going to start with this. What does it mean, chelkas ha-sadeh, the portion of the field that is to our brother, to Elimelech? And we have a lot to cover over here, so we've got to keep the questions to a minimum, unless you really don't understand something. Now,
What don't you understand? Go ahead. Why?
What?
It's so bizarre. Oh, you mean... Anyway, who are the players here? The Kohen Gadol is his brother-in-law, Tam?
His brother-in-law?
Tov.
Not the Kohen Gadol. Elimelech. Elimelech. His brother, Tov. And his nephew, Boaz.
Elimelech is the
Kohen Gadol. Not Kohen Gadol. Not Kohen Gadol here at all.
Who
is
the Gadol?
No.
Goel, the Redeemer. Here we have him. Elimelech,
yeah.
Naomi's father, Boaz's father, Salma, and Tov. Those are the four brothers. Right, you follow?
Okay. So who's his uncle.
If Boaz is with his uncle Tov. These are the two who are having
okay.
How many questions? they're having the discussion. These two. Who's going to redeem Naomi's field with and marry Rus?
Okay, got it.
Okay? Now, what is this portion of the field that is to our brother Elimelech? So we have to deal now a little bit with what the Torah prescribes as the correct method of inheritance, which actually is in this past week's parasha. Parashas Pinchas, we had the inheritance of the Torah. So, Nachshon had land. Nachshon had land. When he died, the land was divided up into four parts, or possibly more, because Elimelech is the Bechor, he's the firstborn. So he may have more parts, he may have a double portion. So Elimelech, Naomi's father, Salma, and Tov, each one gets a portion. Fine. Now, Elimelech died. So who inherited Elimelech's fields when he died?
His sons,
Machlon and Kilion.
Yeah.
Now they died. Who inherited their fields when they died?
Naomi.
Well, a mother never inherits.
So whatever children they have, a wife
never inherits.
So whatever children,
there are no children.
So we go back.
So then you go backwards from Machlon and Kilion. You go back to Elimelech, but he's not alive.
Right.
You go back to Nachshon, but he's not alive.
Right.
Then you go to Nachshon's children.
Right. Okay.
So Elimelech's fields and Machlon and Kilion's fields. Thank you, really, everything. Elimelech's fields and Machlon and Kilion's fields were inherited three ways by Naomi's father, Salma, and Tov. They split this entire line of the family's fields.
Which could have been a double portion.
Were split into thirds. A third was taken by Naomi's father, a third by Salma, a third by Tov. Naomi's father was no longer alive. So who gets his third?
Salma and Tov.
A daughter inherits. Not a wife and not a mother, but a daughter does. So if there's no sons. So since Naomi's father was no longer alive, Naomi got a third of her deceased husband and children's field, but not because she was a wife and not because she was a mother. She got them as a daughter of a brother who inherited from the father. That's why it says a portion of the field, because it's not the entire field of Elimelech. Elimelech's entire field was divided up three ways, of which Boaz currently had a third of it, and Tov currently had a third of it. But the third was owned by Naomi, and that's what's in question right now. That's the part that's being sold, which either Boaz or Tov are going to redeem. Yes.
So would she have a third of her husband's field and then part of her father's inheritance as well?
Yeah. She would have the entirety of her father's inheritance.
So the sons supersede the daughter.
Yes. That's what the Torah, in this past week's parasha, the Torah spells out what the order is.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Doesn't seem fair.
That's a whole different discussion. I gave a shiurim this on Shabbos to the men after davening, but that's not for now.
That's a problem we'll never solve.
No, no, we can easily solve it, but not now. Yeah.
If Tov gives up his right to marry Rus, does he also give up the third, or he just keeps his third?
Well, that's the question we have to deal with, which is why they related to each other. It should be a separate issue. You mean the third that he already has?
Yeah. Right.
No, that he keeps, because
okay.
that he inherited fair and square.
Father.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
It sounds like he held a court, Boaz.
Yes, this is a court case.
So shouldn't he have said, you know, Tov, look, let's get together, let's make a meeting, all of a sudden?
That's what they've had, so they're doing.
That's what I'm saying. He never warned Tov.
He did it right now.
Tov
understood. Tov knew what was going on.
We're having a big meeting here.
Yeah.
This is very important.
Oh, it's huge, as we're about to see. This is gigantic.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So at the end, after Naomi's field is gotten by Boaz, okay, and Boaz dies, so then as a wife, Ruth would inherit Boaz.
No, wives
don't inherit. So what happens to
that? It goes to Obed.
Goes to her son.
Right. It goes to Obed, then to Yisha, then to David.
Eventually he would inherit.
Okay, and does Tov ever have children, do we know?
I'm not aware of it. He may have, but I'm not aware. Well, and he may have had and they died. We don't know. I don't know.
Who did you say doesn't have children besides Boaz?
Tov. Tov apparently doesn't have children.
Oh, so Tov apparently.
Or he doesn't have
Boaz
living children.
Boaz doesn't have children.
Boaz, we know, lost all his children.
Well, what happens? What happens to the wife? What happens to Ruth when Boaz passes away? If they have children, but
she does not inherit. I really can't cover inheritance now. It's just too big.
But what did happen to the women?
I can't. Too much now. Can't get into that. It's another class.
Another
I'm
class.
Sorry. I can't. Okay. So now the in question is that portion of the land, and Boaz and the Goel are discussing who's going to take that land. So when he first suggests it to him, the Goel Tov Ploni Almoni says, "I'll do it. I'll take it. It's my responsibility. I'm the closest relative, so I will do it." But then Boaz says, if you take the land, you also need to marry Rus. So why? What does one thing have to do with the other? So remember, the land was currently owned by Naomi. It wasn't yet sold. It was still owned by Naomi, as we discussed in the last class. If Naomi would sell it, then it would fall to Boaz or Tov to buy the land back. But it hasn't been sold yet. As long as the land hasn't been sold, anybody who sells land can put whatever conditions they want on the sale of the land. Now, the purchaser can opt not to buy. You're not forced to buy anything that you don't want to buy. But the seller can put whatever conditions they want. Naomi and Rus put a condition on this sale. And the condition they put on it was, you have to marry Rus. If you take the land, you have to marry Rus. Now, what would be the rationale to do that? The rationale to do that is, as Boaz himself says in Pasuk Hey in verse 5, Lehakim Shem HaMeis al Nachalaso, to establish the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Because the fact of the matter is that Rus had been married to Mahlon, and when Rus is remarried to the person who also gets Mahlon's land, there will be a degree of establishing Mahlon's name. So this is akin to the Torah's concept of Yibum, of the levirate marriage, which this is not. This is not Yibum. Yibum is when, God forbid, a man dies without any children, leaving a wife, leaving a widow, then there is a mitzvah for the brother to marry that wife, and that's called Yibum. And the purpose of that marriage is to keep his name going. That it perpetuates the name of the person who died without children. That's the purpose of a yibum, of the levirate marriage. So here, that's not what's going on. It's not a brother marrying Rus. So this is not a real yibum. It's not a levirate marriage. But the concept that people will associate the deceased with this woman or with the children that come from this woman, that's what's going on over here. Because if Rus will stay with the land of her husband, as Rashi explains, then whenever Rus is seen on the land, people will remember this is the land of Mahlon. They will remember Mahlon. Say, Zu Eshes Mahlon. This is the wife of Mahlon. This is the land of Mahlon. People will associate Mahlon and the land and the woman. They will remember it all. Whereas if the land would be redeemed by one of the relatives, either Boaz or the Goel, or Tov, and they don't marry Ruth, instead Ruth marries somebody else, she could have married anybody she wanted, then no one will associate the land or the woman with the deceased, with Mahlon. So it's a way of perpetuating the name of Mahlon. That's what they wanted to do. That's what Naomi and Ruth wanted to do. And that is what the Goel is rejecting. He doesn't want to do that. Yes?
But it's only a third of Mahlon or,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Only a third of it's Elimelech. All the rest she'd be walking on would be Boaz's or Naomi's father.
Right.
She was walking
right.
The land.
Right.
So.
Yeah, so you're right. It's not going to be all the land. That's right. But at least there'll be something. At least there'll be some element of remembering the deceased.
And once she was married, she will no longer be known as Ashes. Mahlon, she'll be known as Ashes of the other.
But when you're right. If she would have married somebody who didn't have the land, everybody would forget that she was ever Mahlon's wife.
Right.
And if the land was, the person who got the land didn't marry her, everybody would forget that it used to be Mahlon's land. But by the two of them being together, there's an association. And it clicks in people's minds. Oh, that's, Mahlon, remember Mahlon? Right. That's the idea.
Okay.
Now, if you recall, the first time the Torah ever deals with a situation where someone is to perpetuate somebody else's name, what happens?
Tomorrow.
And what happens over there?
Didn't go well.
Didn't go well. What happens?
They died.
They died. They were killed by Hashem.
Right.
Because the first one, Er, died because he didn't want to have children.
Right.
So he died. But then he was killed. But then Onan is supposed to do Yibum. He's supposed to
marry.
He didn't want to. Rashi explains because he didn't want that the children or the child should be called on his brother's name. He wasn't interested in perpetuating the name of his brother. Now, why not? What's the deeper thing going on over there? That's not for now. But you see that there was, if you want to call it a selfishness, there was an element of that going on with Onan. He didn't want to marry Tamar and have children that would not be known as his own children, but they would be known as Er's children posthumously, really. I mean, after he passed away. So and he was killed for it. They, Er and Onan, should have been the ancestors of
David
HaMelech. That's what should have happened. But they failed. And instead, Yehuda ends up having a relationship with Tamar, and from there comes Peretz, from which all these people come, and eventually David HaMelech. So we see that the line of David HaMelech is one of the challenges, as we spoke about the specialness of the line of David HaMelech, one of the challenges is that there seems to be a recurring theme of someone who is involved but will not be known as the ancestor. And will a person who himself will not be known as the ancestor, will he be willing, he or she, be willing to be involved anyway, selflessly? That it's not about me. This is about the line of David HaMelech that Hashem wants to happen. Even if it's not me that is part of it, even though I am involved, no one's going to remember my name. Will I be willing to go ahead and still get involved in such a situation? Onan didn't want to do it. The Goel over here didn't want to do it. He didn't want to be involved if it's for the sake of Mahlon. It's one thing for me to marry Rus and from there perpetuate myself and create the line of David HaMelech. But when the purpose is for Mahlon, that already takes away from it. And there was a certain selfishness. As we said, the whole purpose of this Megillah is to show where David HaMelech comes from, and the answer to that question is chesed, 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 chesed. Nothing but loving kindness. That's the only thing that produces David HaMelech. Anything else anything but pure acts of chesed will not produce David HaMelech. Chesed is that it's about not about me, it's about another person. And if a person isn't willing to say it's about somebody else, they cannot be the ancestor of David HaMelech. Here the Goel was not able to get past that. Now there's another reason as well. It's not only because of this, which we're about to explore the other reason, but you see the similar struggle that Onan had way back when. Here the Goel has the same struggle. Yes?
So, I wanted to ask a question because it kind of came to me when you were talking about the line of David. No. Did Elimelech, Chilion, and Nachlon had to die in order to purify the line?
They didn't have to die. They could have done better and not died.
I'm sorry?
They could have done better and not died. It's because they did the wrong thing that they died.
No, I know, but because they did the wrong thing,
right,
they died.
Right.
But so that they couldn't live and then pass on that through to David's line.
Right.
Is that correct?
Apparently. Apparently. Yeah. Apparently.
Because they could have lived, but then that would have tainted.
Evidently, because it wasn't as pure as it should have been.
Right.
Evidently, that's true. Baruch Ato Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam
Shehakol Nivra. Was this Tov really aware that David HaMelech would come from it? Because you would think that he would be interested anyway.
They were all aware of the possibility. They didn't know for certain, but they were all aware. And that's why Elimelech had gone to Moab in the first place. Now, there's another dynamic going on. And this we've discussed already, and most of you are already aware of this, is that the whole question of whether Rus was an acceptable person to marry into the Jewish people was also a question. Because she came from Moab, she came from the Moab nation, and the Torah says, a Moavi lo yavo bikal Hashem, cannot marry into the Jewish people. That is prohibited. There was a debate whether that included the women or not. Moavi vafilu Moavis, umavi velo Moavis. Does it include the women or doesn't include the women? At this time, Boaz, who was the head of the court, he ruled that a Moavis is permitted. A Moavi woman is permitted. But the rule is that if a court rules in a certain way, and any law, that law can be overturned in the future if a future high court is greater than the previous one, the one that ruled this way. Now, we don't have this problem today because we can't produce Talmidei Chachamim, sages, that are as great as those who came before us. So all the previous rulings stand. We can't overturn anything. That's not going to happen until Mashiach comes. But in the time of Boaz, this was a very real concern. It was possible that in the future there would arise a Beis Din, a court that would be greater than Boaz's Beis Din, that could theoretically overturn Boaz's ruling. And in fact, it did happen in the time of David HaMelech. In the time of David, of King David, before he became king, when Saul was still king, at that time, this question came up again. And the head of the court at that time was, we're going to learn about him next year, Mitzvah Hashem, when we learn Shmuel, was, Not Shmuel. Was Doeg. Doeg HaAdomi was the head of the court. And he ruled that even the women cannot marry in. Even the women cannot marry in. And therefore, David's lineage was now in question. And that became a big issue. Now, eventually it was put to rest because eventually someone came forward. Again, we're going to discuss this all hopefully next year, but someone came forward and brought testimony from the court of Shmuel of Samuel that preceded all of them that had a direct transmission from Moshe himself, in other words, from Rebbe to student, Rebbe to Talmud, all the way back to Moshe, that Moshe ruled that the women are permitted. So once that was established, it couldn't be overturned anymore. You can't be greater than Moshe himself. That you can't do. No court can be as great as that. So once that was established, it was from Moshe, there was no more overturning it. But at this time, in the time of Rus, it could potentially have been overturned. And the Goel said, I can't redeem, pen ashchis es nachalasi, lest I I destroy my inheritance, meaning my future. Not me. I understand now she's permitted, but what's going to happen in the future if a court overturns the ruling that you, Boaz, have ruled? And therefore, he did not want to do it. He did not want to redeem Rus. So these are the reasons why he didn't want to do it. Yes?
So they didn't know that this law existed? I mean, Boaz ruled on it. He didn't know that the rule came from Samuel?
And no, they did not know it came from Moshe.
He didn't know it came from Moshe?
No. No, not at this time. They did not have it.
Did he rule? When did he make this ruling? Before he met?
A little bit earlier. This is discussed in the Talmud. You can't rule on something that is relevant to you.
Right.
It's got to be right. So that's discussed. But yeah, it was prior to this.
Before he met Ruth.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, what is this exchange? This the shoe or the glove? So we know that in order to acquire things, to take ownership of something, you need to do something that would be called a kinyan, an acquisition. This is true not only of Jewish law, it's true of any legal system. There has to be some way that a sale is considered final. Now, most of the time when we go to a store, when is the sale considered final? When you pay for it. When you pay for it, right? That's usually how it works.
Pesach time is a good example.
Okay, so for us, there are various types of kinyan and various types of acquisitions that can be done. Sometimes it can be by paying for something. Sometimes it's by lifting something up to acquire it. That's one way to do it. Which means that here, this Mrs. Starkman brought this bottle in tonight, and she gave it to me. So she gifted this to me. But when does it become mine? When is it mine? She put it down in front of me. Let's say she decided that, you know what, I don't want to give it to you, I'm taking it back. Can I go, yeah, but you put it down in front of me already, it's mine already. But I didn't do anything to acquire it. Just because she put it down in front of me and she had in mind that I should acquire it, and I had in mind that I should acquire it, but I never did anything to acquire it, it's not mine yet, it's still hers. But if she had in mind that I should acquire it, and I had in mind to acquire it, and I lifted it up, now it's mine. Now she says, oh, you know what, I don't want you to have it anymore. It's not her decision anymore. It's mine. She can't take it back. It belongs to me. The act of acquisition was lifting it up. That would be an example. So that's great when you're talking about a water bottle. But there are certain things that can't be lifted up. For example, a field. Can't lift up a field. Or
you can buy it for a dollar.
You can buy it for a dollar. That you can do, but you can't lift it up. You also can't lift up an agreement. An agreement. See, an agreement is different. Let's say we make an agreement about we're going to do something. We agree that we're going to have some sort of an arrangement where we're neighbors, and we're going to have some sort of arrangement where you're going to use my driveway for your extra car, and I'm going to have the right to use your backyard for the barbecue I want to have. We just talk about it, but why are we bound to do it? Just because we talked about it doesn't make us bound to do it. But we can do something to acquire that acquisition, to make that acquisition real, to make it something which is legally binding. So you have to do some sort of an acquisition. Well, what are you going to lift up the driveway? Lift up the backyard? What are you going to do exactly? So the one of the ways of doing it is to do a kinyan, to do an acquisition called a chalipin, which means an exchange. And the way that works is that you take an item, and you pass the item from one to the other. And you take something that belongs to one of them, he gives it to the other one, and the other one lifts it up, and in so doing, the entire agreement has been now acquired, has now been set in stone. That's the act of chalipin. There is a debate amongst the decisors, who gives whom, the item. Is it the purchaser gives the item to the seller, or the seller gives the item to the purchaser? That's a little bit of a debate. But whatever it is, and actually the debate comes from here, because it doesn't say who took off whose shoe or glove. It just says he, with a pronoun, took off his shoe or his glove. It doesn't say who did it. Was it Boaz or was it Tov? Either way, that's what's happening over here. The most common place that you see this It can be done with Pesach, it's true, but really you see it at weddings. If you've ever had the opportunity to see what goes on at the chasen's tish, if you haven't actually been there, if you've seen it on a video, and see what goes on when they're signing the ksuba, so the Misadar Kedushin, the one who's running the show, has to have the chasen, the groom, has to do some sort of a kinyan acquisition to obligate himself in everything that it says in that document, mm-hmm. as the witness before the witnesses sign. So in front of the witnesses, usually the Misadar Kedushin, the one who's running the show, will take out, he's usually wearing a hat, he'll take his yarmulke off from under his hat, or he'll take his wallet out of his pocket, or a pen, or something like that, and have either the chasen or the witnesses, or whatever it is, will lift up the item to acquire, to set in stone what they're about to sign and do. That's a standard feature at every Jewish wedding. So there's an example of it. Before Pesach, with selling the chametz, there's also a possibility of doing that sort of thing. So that is what's going on over here as well. Okay.
So if there's an exchange, why is lifting?
That's part of the acquiring, acquisition.
How is that acquiring? What kind of exchange is that?
It's by lifting the item that is being handed one to the other, everything else becomes included in that acquisition.
So he's getting married, the groom's getting married. How is his yarmulke?
Or
his wallet.
Right. Yeah. It's a legally binding action. It's similar, like we know that there's even in the legal system today.
Why not take
often
the ring?
In the legal system today, a handshake can often be the thing that right, that binds the two.
Right.
So here, this is the process that's used to bind the two. It doesn't make the marriage happen. The marriage is later. This is just the ksuba part of it,
mm-hmm.
just the contract. Yeah.
Can the six stalks of barley be lifted this way?
So that's a possibility, but the six stalks of barley were between Boaz and Ruth, not between Boaz and the Goel.
Yes,
here it was the two of them.
But obligating himself by transferring property, though minimal, was he obligating himself to those
It could be. It could be that was going on. As we talked, we had an email exchange.
Right.
It seems from the psukim, from the verses, that he was giving a gift to Nami. But it's possible.
Right. Yes.
But it's possible that was going on as well. Yeah.
So the shoe, in this case, represents the third. Is that?
Well, it represents the agreement between Boaz and the Goel that the Goel would not exercise his right, and instead Boaz would exercise his right to do it. And in so doing, the Goel was relinquishing his right to be the first in line to acquire the field, and instead now Boaz had the right to do it.
And is that considered not doing keseth?
They would not have used.
Is it a neutral?
They would not. They didn't use money because neither one was giving anything of substance to either one. The Goel was giving up a right,
mm-hmm.
and Boaz was exercising a right. Eventually, he would buy the field from Nami. That was with money. But this was just the right to do that purchase.
Okay.
So it's... All right.
Okay.
So who's going to... Right. Okay.
So isn't Pasuk Ches indicating that the Goel took off his shoe to Boaz?
It's not clear. You can read it either way.
What?
You can be ready to do it.
Is it similar to Yibum where the person refuses to do it and so that person take off his shoe?
Well, that's true. That's true when there's a chalitza. When Yibum is not performed, they do that. There does seem to parallel that, but it's not the same thing going on over here as that. Pasuk Tes verse 9. Vayomer Boaz Lazakenim, Boaz said to the elders, V'chol ha'am and to all the nation, Eidim atem hayom, you are witnesses today, ki konisti es kol asher l'Elimelech, that I have acquired all that belongs to Elimelech, Beis kol asher l'chilion u'machlon, and all that belongs to Chilion and Machlon, miyad Nami, from Nami. Now, it doesn't mean every single thing they own, but it means whatever Nami had of theirs, I am now acquiring. The gametz Rus ha-Moaviyah, eshes Machlon, also Rus the Moaviyah, the wife of Machlon, konisi li li isha, I am acquiring for me as a wife, Why? Lehakim Shem Hameis al Nachalaso, in order to establish the name of the deceased on his inheritance. V'lo yikareis Shem Hameis mi'imechav u'mishar mekamo, and the name of the deceased should not be cut off from his brothers and from the gates of his place. I want everybody to remember Machlon. It's not about me. This is about Machlon. He states it openly and clearly. I want everybody to remember Machlon. Edim atem ayom, your witnesses today. Vayomru kol ha'ama shabashar v'azekinim edim, and all the nation that was in the gate and the elders who are witnesses said, Yitain Hashem et ha'isha ha'ba'a el beisecha, Hashem should give this woman who is coming into your house, he should make her, ki Rachel u'chaleah, like Rachel and like Leah, asher banu sheteyem es beis Yisrael, that they both built the house of Israel. Va'asechayo be'efrasa, you should do, what does it say, great things? You should
prosper,
okay. In Ephras, u'krashem beis lachem, and you should call name, which means you should become well known, in beis lachem. V'hi beischa k'beis peretz, your house should be like the house of Peretz. Since everybody knew that Peretz was the one who was going to produce David HaMelech, your house should be like the house of Peretz. Asher yolda Tamar li Yehuda, that Tamar bore for Yehuda. You see how they are invoking Tamar and Yehuda in the story here of Ruth and Boaz. Min hazera sheyitein Hashem lecha, that from the seed that Hashem will give to you. Min hana'arah hazos, from this young lady. She was 40, he was 80. From this young lady. Vayikach Boaz es Ruth vatilo liisha, and Boaz took Ruth, and she was for him as a wife. Vayavo eleha, they were intimate. Vayitein Hashem la hirayon, Hashem gave her a pregnancy, a conception. Vatelet bein, and she bore a son. Now we know from the Medrash that they got married, they had that one night, and then he died. And that was it. Those who were his detractors, and those who wanted to say that it was prohibited to marry Ruth, they took this as a sign, you see, he died. Why did he die? Because he sinned. Because he married Ruth. You gotta be very careful with these signs from heaven. Because you can easily read it the wrong way. That's what his detractors wanted to say. It was proof that one should not have married Ruth.
Only you could say that he lived one more day.
So that's the other way to look at it. That Hashem preserved him one more day. And also made it possible for her to conceive on that one night, because that's all they had. And that was enough. And that produced the line of David HaMelech, which is in fact what happened.
Didn't he also, by all of this, fulfill what Hashem had wanted from him? So dying was...
His mission was over.
His mission was over.
Yeah, that's what it appears happened. Right. Okay. That's right.
Malik conceived with his wife in that one
that's,
night.
That's
too.
Right.
So I don't know that you could take that into
okay.
Mind.
Okay.
Do you think you knew that?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if you know that.
I wonder if he had any kind of...
You see that he had altruistic reasons, that he wanted to perpetuate the name of Machlon. That was his primary reason for what he did, but he does merit to become the ancestor of David HaMelech. A point to make over here that Chazal say, our sages say, and Rashi also says, that in Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, they say, Hashem should make your house... make this woman like Rachel and like Leah. Now these were people of Yehuda speaking. Yehuda comes from Leah, not from Rachel. And they said, your house should be like Rachel, she should be like Rachel and like Leah. So they put Rachel first. So they acknowledged that Rachel was the main wife. Even though they came from Leah, they acknowledged that Rachel was the main one, because Yaakov only went to Laban because of Rachel.
You said that these are a very powerful blessing.
Is yes.
It's one person?
No, it's the group of people who were there that he had convened.
They all in one
yeah, in unison.
Breath
yeah.
Decided to say the same exact thing.
Okay, I imagine it was different pronouncements that were of this nature.
Okay.
Was this a wedding ceremony sort of thing?
Well, they got married. I mean, that's what happened.
Once she marries Boaz, she's no longer called Ruth Hamavis. You notice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is something unique. A happy ending.
Okay, well, I mean, it's happy, but it's a little bittersweet. I mean, her husband dies.
Yeah.
Now, but we're not done yet. There's still more here. So she becomes pregnant, and she has a child. Vatomarna hanashim el nami. Okay, wait, I just want to make sure I remember the loose ends we have to cover here. Batomar nahanoshim al Nami. The women said to Nami, Baruch Hashem, blessed is Hashem, Ashalo hishpith lach goel hayom, that he did not withhold from you a redeemer today. V'kare shemo b'Yisrael, and his name should be known among in Israel. Now this is a funny pronouncement to say. Hashem has not held back from you a redeemer today, and his name should be called in Israel. Who are they talking about? Who's the redeemer and whose name?
The son.
The son that Boaz had with Ruth. Hashem has not withheld from you a redeemer today, and his name, the name of this child, should become known in Israel. Whose child is this?
Boaz
and Ruth.
Not Naomi.
Is Naomi, is she a blood relative to this child? I mean,
no.
It's her cousin's kid.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Naomi is not, it's not her, she's not the mother, she's not the grandmother. This is her former daughter-in-law, who's now married to her first cousin, who had a child.
Right.
And they're saying that Hashem did not hold back from you a redeemer today, and his name should be known in Israel. For Hayalach Lameshiv Nefesh, he, this child, should be for you as a comforter of the soul. Is that how they say it there?
Life restorer.
Okay. Ulecha Kelas Seva Seich, and to sustain your old age. Ki Chalos Seich Asher Ahevasech Yiladatu, for your daughter-in-law who loved you, bore him. Asher he tovalach, that she was better for you, mishiva banim, from seven sons. She was even better for you than seven sons. So the women are saying to Naomi something about this child, who is not her child and not her grandchild. This child is for you. She's going, this child is, it should have a name, and he's a redeemer, and he's going to take care of your old age. Vatikach Naomi et hayeled, and Naomi took the child, vatishisehu v'cheka, and she took him in her embrace. Vatilo leomenes, and she was for the child as a
wet nurse.
What, does it say wet nurse there?
A nurse.
Is she an aunt?
It's her cousin's child. Her first cousin's child.
If you say it's al shem machlon, it's like a grandchild.
Okay, so hold on. Good. So she was a nurse, which means she helped raise the child. Mm-hmm. That's what happened over here. Vatikrena lo hashecheno shem leimor. And the neighbors, the women, called a name on this child, saying, Yulad Bain Linami. A son was born to Nami. Vatikrena shemo Oved. They called him Oved. Hu avi Ishai? Avi David. He, this child, who is the child of who? Of Nami, is the father of Yishai, who is the father of David. Nami is not the blood mother. Nami had a daughter-in-law. Nami's children died. Remember, Nami said, I have no hope. There's no hope for me anymore. I'm finished. Mm-hmm. Even if I were to marry, I'm done. I'm Mara. I'm bitter. There's nothing can be done. I'm finished. My life is over. I'm a failure. Everything that I was hoping for was failed. But in the end, Naomi is called the mother of Oved, who is the mother of Yishai. This doesn't take away from Ruth, but Ruth, at the end of the day, was a Moabiah. She was a Moabite woman, and it would seem almost without question that she would need significant help raising a child properly amongst the Jewish nation. Who's going to help her raise this child? Her mother-in-law, Naomi, who is her former mother-in-law, I should say, who is the one who she loves and is stuck with her from the beginning. And now, Naomi, who orchestrated the whole thing, is credited with partially being the mother of this child, Oved, who is the father of Yishai, who is the father of David. So in the end, David's ancestry, although the line goes from David back to Yishai, back to Oved, back to Boaz, back to Salma, back to Nachshon. It doesn't follow the line of Naomi or Elimelech or any of that, but Naomi still finds her name in there, even though she was not married to any of the people in David's line, and even though she was only a cousin, but she, as the orchestrator and also as the one raising this child, she is called the mother of this child of Oved, the father, who is the father of Yishai, the father of David.
So that's her reward.
that is her ultimate reward. It's what she deserves because she was willing to have the self sacrifice in this way. Yeah.
Normally, you know, when the Rebbe teaches a child Torah, he's considered like the father of the child. So there could be something synonymous to Naomi here because she raised a child the ways of, you know, Clive's child.
Yes. This is no different than we find that the children of Bilha and Zilpah are called the children of Rachel and Leah because they were primarily raised by the other women. This is what should have happened with Hagar and Sarah, but didn't. That was the idea over there. We talked about that at the time. So this is a very similar idea. Yeah.
I think it's interesting. Everybody was saying it should be in the name of Mahlon, and then at the end, it's all about Naomi.
It's all about Naomi, right?
You don't see Mahlon mentioned by these women at all.
No, the women are talking about Naomi, but she becomes the Naomi, and is very much the heroine of this story. Meaning, Ruth and Boaz are for sure the two main players. They're the ones who each put in incredible self-sacrifice. The chesed that they exude is what produces David HaMelech. That's clear. But Naomi is the one behind the scenes and the one pushing everybody in the right direction. And she conceived of the whole idea, and she was the ultimate Shadchan, as we pointed out. And from here comes Oved, then Yishai, then David. Yes?
What does Oved mean?
Oved means to serve. He was an Oved Hashem.
So that's why they...
Why do the neighbors call
him? Right. I don't know why. I don't know. It sounds like at the Bris he had a different name. I don't know. Now let's read the rest, but we're not finished. There's still a few more little sentences. Yes.
Okay. You can answer the question, the relationship here, because what started out what could be considered not kosher exactly was Yehuda and Tamar, and you have parrots being born and this twin, and then now with
you mean now you have another case where it's appeared not to be kosher, right, as we explained last time, right, that's right. Now, the Navi, Shmuel, who wrote this, now wants to give us the entire lineage of David, so that we'll know the entire thing. Now that we've gone through all of what could have been, should have been, would have been, whatever it is, now let's see what really happened. Ve'ela told us Peretz, these are the descendants of Peretz. Peretz holidas Chetzron. Peretz had Chetzron. The Chetzron holidas Ram. Chetzron had Ram. Ram holidas Aminadav. He had Aminadav. Aminadav holidas Nachshon. There we have it on the board. The Nachshon holidas Salma. That's the next one. The Salma holidas Boaz. Boaz holidas Oved. Oved is the next one. The Oved holidas Yishai. He had Yishai. The Yishai holidas David. It's 10 generations from Peretz to David. And it was not as smooth as this list implies. There were turbulent times in getting from Peretz to David. As we explained, it was not the last time there was turbulent times in the line of David HaMelech. It is a frequent occurrence in the line both of producing David and then since David HaMelech in preserving that line that there are turbulent bumps in the road. Why is he called Ploni Almoni?
Because he didn't rise to the occasion.
Because he didn't rise to the occasion. Did Tov do anything wrong? This is an interesting question. To me, this is one of the fascinating things about the whole Megillah. Elimelech did something wrong. He was killed. Mahlon and Kilion did things that were wrong. They were killed. They shouldn't have done what they did. But they tried something. Right? They tried. They had a plan. There was a plan over here. It was the wrong plan. And they were killed for it. So it was a pretty dangerous thing to try. So they were killed for it. But they tried something. They were killed. Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion are remembered in history. In Rus. Elimelech tried. Failed. He was killed. Mahlon and Kilion, they were killed. Naomi, well, she started off with the same plan as her husband and sons and failed. But in the end, she orchestrates the rest. Of course, Boaz is etched in history as the great-grandfather of David
HaMelech. He did something wrong, but his kids were killed and his wife and not him.
Who did something wrong?
Boaz, because he didn't invite Manoah.
Yeah, okay, that's true.
So he did something wrong, but his kids were killed and not him. So explain that as long as you're going along.
Evidently, it wasn't so bad.
was bad enough to kill 60 kids.
Well, yeah, but like we said, whenever you find something like that, it means that there were other things going on over there. It wasn't that the kids were lily white. There were other things happening. Whether they were is not, the Gemara is not interested in telling us that. The Gemara cares about what, about Boaz, who ends up being the ancestor of David HaMelech. But at any rate, regarding our story, Boaz is the one who rises to the occasion. Ruth rises to the occasion. Naomi rises to the occasion. Tov, or the Goel, or Ploni Aloni, did he do anything bad? Was he a bad person?
Yeah.
Played
it safe.
He played it safe. He played it safe. He was cautious, a little too cautious. He has the chance. It's ironic. He's referred to as Tov once in the Megillah. Okay. He's referred to as Ploni Aloni once in the Megillah. What is he regularly referred to?
Goel.
The Goel, the Redeemer. Now the context is the Redeemer of the land, but it's inescapable to connect that with the Redeemer of the Jews.
Yeah.
Of the Jews.
Yeah.
As Mashiach.
Right.
He could have been the Goel. He could have been the ancestor of Mashiach himself. The Redeemer. That's what he could have been. The whole time he's being called the Goel, the Goel, the Goel, the Goel, the Goel.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, he's Ploni Aloni. He's nobody. He ended up being nobody. He didn't rise to the occasion. He had the opportunity. He was in his hands. He was first in line. He could have done it. And it was his to do. It was his to give up. He could have done it. No one could have stopped him. And he gave it up. So he's Ploni Aloni. He's no name.
What
the
did,
Megillah,
why did he give it up again?
What, he gave up the opportunity to marry Ruth.
I know, but why again?
Well, we said before, two reasons. One was because it had to do with somebody else, with Mahlon.
And he didn't want to give the honor to his...
Right. And then also he was afraid of the consequences later on in history. But the Megillah is telling us that besides the lesson of Chesed, which is the ultimate lesson of this Megillah, and the lesson of always trying to do what is correct for Hashem's sake, and not trying to figure out ways of outsmarting Hashem, of going to Moab and all that, but you also have the clear message, don't sit on the sidelines. You have the opportunity to be front and center and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And take the bull by the horns and do it. Don't sit there on the sidelines and let it happen. You can be in the background. That's not the same thing as the sidelines. Naomi is in the background. And because she's in the background in the right way, it rises to great heights. And that's not wrong, to be in the background. That's not, you don't have to be in the limelight. But don't sit on the sidelines. Don't sit on your hands. Get up and do whatever you can possibly do. Yes?
So, Tov?
Yeah.
Tov could have been the Redeemer. But there's also an element of ego, it sounds to me, you know, here. Like, you know, oh, in the future generations, I'm not going to be acknowledged.
Yeah, that's what it seems.
Right?
It seems there's something like that going on here.
It's more rather than benevolence.
Yeah, but he didn't sin. He didn't do anything wrong.
No.
Right?
No.
He just didn't do. Just sat back.
Yeah, because he was worried about his own.
Right.
He didn't step up to the plate.
Right.
Well, I said something different from Tom. I got that he was worried about future generations because of the status of Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I understood, whether it's right or not.
No, that's true.
But not for children, not as an ego thing. But and the other thing about Tom is he becomes Ploni Aloni because he could have had a name. So now he's no name.
Right.
But we still don't know who Naomi's father is. So he's not Ploni Aloni.
Yeah, I don't know who it was. It could be it's listed somewhere.
Okay.
It could be it is. It's not listed here, but it could be it is listed elsewhere. It could be listed elsewhere. So here we have at least a complete story of Megillas Rus. Now there is a whole other piece of this puzzle, which I have not presented to you, because it's just a whole other. I mean, there's much more to talk about. We covered a lot of Rus. We covered really a lot of what there is over here. It remains to me one of the most fascinating stories in the Tanakh. All of the players are listed right here. Every single one that's in this Megillah are here. We read about all of them. I mean, Arpa got it written, but she was there as well.
Right.
And we went through this, and this is the line of David HaMelech. And there's much more to say about the line of David HaMelech and how fascinating that is. Now,
Is last week's class on the...
Yeah.
Okay.
It should be there. I mean,
it is there.
It is there. Okay. Yes.
I just want to add something. Rabbi Solanta, one of his many attributes that he lists that's good for us to do, we learn from this here, zrizus, to be zealous. You have an opportunity to do something, run and go for it. So I used to tell my kids, if you don't run to do the mitzvah is going to run away from you. And that's a tov. And there's an zrizus here, an opportunity to do it, and he missed that out.
Yes.
You know, the sideline, when I think about all these women and how they come in to the end of it, they come in to this play. This is basically a play. And the women have appeared before as a chorus, and they appear as a chorus again at the end. And I think it's an interesting counterpoint to the men sitting at the gate. You know, you've got this court of men who end up ratifying this marriage and ratifying this deal. And then the scene switches, and you have a company of women ratifying the
right.
deal.
Right. That's right.
It's sort of an interesting, I see it in my mind's eye, you know, as a play.
Well, the clearly the women are the main players. I mean, the fact that the Megillah itself is called Rus, not called Boaz, it's called Rus. Mm-hmm. Clearly the issue here is the women. The Rus is called Ima Shel Malchus, the mother of royalty. And Rus will appear later on in the book of Melachim, the book of Kings, in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. Now Shlomo Solomon is her great, great grandson. And at that time, there is an episode there where the verse says, they brought a chair La'aim HaMelech, for the mother of the king. The simple meaning is it's Shlomo's mother. His mother was Bathsheba. But the Medrash says it was Rus, that Rus was still alive, and they brought a chair for the mother of Shlomo. She's the mother of royalty. That's what she ends up being called.
She's still alive
at that time. She lives a long life. She's already 40 in this episode, and she lives to see her great, great grandson become king. Now, there is one more point which I would make to you, which is uniquely a women's point, but it is 9 o'clock. Now, I'm happy to go for another, it'll take about another 10 minutes or so. You can feel free to walk out, don't stay on my account, but I would share this with you just to fill in one more piece of it. The Gemara, when discussing the question of whether a Moabi woman should or should not be excluded from the Jewish people. We know the men are excluded, but not the women. But there's a discussion about it, yes or no. So what does this discussion revolve around? This is very, very important. Why are the men excluded from the Jewish people? The verse says that you cannot let them join the Jewish people even 10 generations. In other words, even if a Moabi man converts, he cannot marry a regular Jewish woman even 10 generations later. Can never marry into the Jewish people. Why is that?
Because they weren't hospitable.
They weren't hospitable. That's what it says. This is al-davar shalokidmo eskem balechem uvamayim. They didn't bring you bread and water on the road when you left Egypt. They are your cousins. They only exist because of Avraham. Avraham's merit saved Lot, their great-grandfather, and they owed it to you to treat you properly. They should have brought you bread and water. And instead of bringing you bread and water, what did they do?
Wage war.
Not only did they wage war, they
sent out their Midianites.
The Midianite women, and also 2 weeks ago, they hired Bilaam to curse us.
Right.
So they're no good for nothings. All they wanted to do was hurt us, when really they should have given us bread and water. They should have showered us with gifts. Okay, so they are excluded. And the Torah says, a very strong language, Lo sidrosh shlomam v'tovasam. Don't seek their peace or their good. Kol yomecha, all your days, le'olam forever. Don't make peace with them. Don't be nice to them. You are to despise them. Not to kill them out. It's not like Amalek, but you are to despise them. They are despicable. Now, that's the men. What about the women? So, the reason why the women are not excluded, why aren't the women excluded as well, is because you can't blame the women. Why can't you blame the women? Because it would not be within the framework of modesty for women to bring the food out to the nation. Here you have a nation of Jews who are passing by. It's a lot of people, you know, millions of people. They're passing by the Moab nation, and now the Moab nation is supposed to come out with bread and water for the Jewish people. So who's going to bring the bread and water out?
The men.
The men are expected to. Are the women expected to? No, because it would not be tsanua, it would not be the appropriate level of modesty for them to come out. So therefore, they are not excluded, because you can't blame them. What did they do wrong? That even if they wanted to bring out bread and water, but they didn't, they wouldn't be expected to do it.
Couldn't they have made their husbands do it?
Evidently, the husbands didn't want to. Okay, you're bringing up the point that a woman should affect the men. Okay,
so Cosby and her friends were modest. Is that what we're saying here?
Good, very good. Hold on. So,
right.
So, but you can't blame them for not bringing out the bread and water. Now, Doeg later on in history, who is going to say that the women are excluded? They are excluded. What was his rationale? What was Doeg's rationale to say they should be excluded? Because Doeg said, I understand that the men were expected to bring out the bread and water. You're not going to have women bring bread and water to the men. That's not appropriate. But why couldn't the women have brought bread and water to the women? Why not that? Let the men bring the bread and water to the men, and let the women bring the bread and water to the women. So you can blame the women. They should have brought the bread and water to their two women. That wouldn't have been immodest. So, therefore, they are just as culpable as the men. That was Doeg's argument. His argument was that the women are just as bad as the men, because they should have brought bread and water to the women. And since they didn't, they are also excluded from the Jewish people.
That's a weak argument.
Why?
Because in a marriage, you know, if the man doesn't want to do it...
Okay.
All right, I'm doing it in those times, the women couldn't...
Okay. Okay.
Isn't that true?
Okay.
Abigail did it even though her husband didn't want to give food and water to David. Abigail went out herself.
That's right.
And did not.
Well, she was making amends for how her husband treated her.
Women more likely were
she
like
went out,
chattel. And they, chattel, not cattle. But they didn't have the rights. They were so oppressed.
Okay. So
that they couldn't do anything without the husband telling them.
Okay.
Well, I think another issue is that why would we think that the women, the Israeli women, would be traveling in a body and that other women could approach them without being seen by men?
And you're saying if it was men and women...
They were traveling by tribes. Nowhere do we hear that they're traveling by gender.
Right.
And
they weren't.
Why would we ever think that the Moabite women could leave their tents en masse and approach Israelite women and not be...
Okay.
But the woman issue, the compassionate ones, you'd think a woman would take that opportunity. The women are more soft.
Okay, so
it's
just one. Wait. So the Gemara then says, but Doeg is wrong. The women are not excluded. The women did not do anything wrong. They were not expected to bring out the bread and water. So what about his point that let them bring the bread and water to the women? So the Gemara answers with two answers, but it's the same point. The Gemara says, "Kol kruda bas melech penima." All of the honor of a Jewish woman is internal. That it is not honorable for a Jewish woman to be seen in a public way. That's not an honorable thing. A Jewish woman should be seen, should be in a private manner. So really, what Dr. Faria is saying is correct. That there is that this wasn't a situation of the women were in one room and the men were in another room, so let the women go to the women. The women were interspersed amongst the men. How are the women going to bring bread and water to the women unless they're actually marching through the camp? That does lead to a certain degree of immodesty, even though they weren't coming to socialize with the men. The other way that Gemara says it is that Sarah, when the angels come to Abraham, so it said they say to Abraham, where is Sarah? And he says, Hine ba'ohel, she's in the tent. She's in the tent. So the Gemara says, you see from the mother of the Jewish people, Sarah, that she's in the tent. She's not out there when the men are coming to visit Avraham. So what the Gemara is saying is that the women of Moab were not expected to bring the bread and water out because although it's true, it's not very immodest for them to go to the women, but Jewish women are expected to have an extra measure of modesty. And Jewish women, in order to join the Jewish people, you have to be able to have that degree of modesty. Now, what Mrs. Lewis is saying is, but the Moabite women were immodest. They were as bad as they could be. Look what happened in last week's parasha. Look what they did. The Midian women are going to be killed out in this week's parasha for this whole thing. So look what's going on over here. So the point wasn't, were the Moabite women in general modest or not? That was not the point. The point was, are Moabite women capable of modesty or not? That was the question. Doeg was saying, Moabite women, they're not capable of this extra measure of modesty. Therefore, they should have been there to bring the bread and water because that's who they are. What do you mean? They're terribly immodest people. So, of course, they should have brought the bread and water to the women. What are you expecting from them? But we don't rule that way. We rule that it's true. They were very immodest, but they were capable of modesty. And since they were capable of modesty, therefore, they are not held accountable. In order for Ruth to be that preda tova, that good bird, she had to be that unusual but possible Moabite woman who could be like a Jewish woman, who could be one to project that modesty. That's why earlier in the story we find that the thing that Boaz notices about her is her modesty. Right. Now, that's a nice thing. It's beautiful to talk about modesty of a woman, but it seems almost like a non sequitur. What does that have to do with the story? We're talking about chesed over here. But modesty is very important because the whole reason why the Moabite women can join the Jewish people is because they really are capable of that modesty. And Ruth demonstrates that she is that woman and she can have that modesty. And the truth is that the chesed that a person does, chesed can be done in the spotlight, in front of everybody, bringing the bread and water to everybody. That's chesed. Isn't that chesed? It is chesed. But chesed, especially for a woman, has to be tempered with modesty. There's a way of doing the chesed and a way that the chesed is not appropriate. It's still chesed. But it's got to be tempered with modesty. Ruth was that perfect blend. She had grown in her own self, and she was a person who had both aspects. She had that incredible self-sacrifice for chesed, and at the same time, she had that modesty to go with it. That's why she becomes the mother of royalty. Yes?
Well, isn't it possible that the Moabite women encouraged their husbands and the males to do the right thing and bring bread and water, but they refuse?
It is possible. We don't know.
That would be sort of something that a woman might do.
It is very possible. It is very possible, and that's really what was said before, that there is an expectation that the women try to affect the men in that way. And it could be that they were ignored. It is possible.
But Abigail wasn't taken to task for doing what
right,
she did.
Right. Right, Abigail.
So it wasn't considered immodest for her to go in front of all these troops by herself.
Right.
She did the right thing. She went out to provide.
Right. So how can it be seen as the right thing there and not like she didn't?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that is a story which hopefully we're going to cover next year. That's a good question, but isn't that an immodest act? Right. Now over there, she was making amends for something that her husband had already done wrong. Her husband had mistreated David's people.
Well, and the Moabites had already mistreated the Jewish people. So the next
not at that.
Well,
the next day. Okay, all right, that's a good point. All right, we'll have to cover that.
Also, Abigail was Jewish. But
she is considered to be of the greatest of the Jewish women.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.